On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Groundwater Statistics for Environmental Project Managers. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover information on the first few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. As listed on the slide, today's training is based on the online guidance document, Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance. We're going to introduce you to this web-based document, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training class. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. We are recording this event. The trainers control the slides. If you'd like to control your own slides, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where you started today. We do look forward to your questions and feedback. Throughout the training class, you are welcome to type in a question using the Q&A box. At the breaks, we're going to ask some of those questions out loud. Also, if you're on the phone line, you can unmute and jump in with a question as well. At the end of the class, we do ask that everyone complete the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's training class. And at this point, the only way to get that certificate is by completing the feedback form. Check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. If you have more than one person at your location, the next person can go back and fill out the feedback form again. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. We have a newly updated website, so I do encourage you to visit it. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We also encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We do ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC uses policy, and let us know about your successes. The use of ITRC material for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of guidance documents. We have classroom training and online training available. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers were members of the ITRC Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance Team. That team was led by Ningwu Chang of the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. Harold Templin is a senior geologist at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management in Indianapolis. He has designed or improved groundwater monitoring systems, sampling and analysis plans, and statistical evaluation plans. Chris Stubbs is a principal consultant with Ramble Environ. His specific areas of expertise include groundwater modeling, statistical analysis, risk-based site assessment remediation, exposure analysis, and human health risk assessment. Liz Simmons is a principal geologist and technical practice leader for environmental site characterization for Kleinfelder in San Diego, California. Her extensive technical background includes numerous groundwater assessments, risk assessments, modeling, groundwater optimization, and litigation support. Randall Wrighty is a senior scientist with Neptune & Company in Los Alamos, New Mexico. His work includes ecological and human health risk assessment, supporting clients with groundwater over large spatial scales with multiple stressors, large complex databases, and significant involvement of regulators, natural resource trustees, and the public. On slide six, I'm now going to turn the presentation over to Harold Templin of the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Harold?
Okay, thank you, Juliana. And as we start the training today, allow me to set the stage for using statistics to evaluate your groundwater data. In my work at the state of Indiana, I've had mounds of groundwater data come across my desk, and it seems like people come by and are wondering, how do you know that you're properly evaluating this data? How do you know that you have the right data and what's it telling you? And I note that there's confusion about groundwater statistics and how you proceed to use it. The use of statistics to evaluate groundwater data depends upon an adequate evidence of the data quality, a sufficient amount of data, and proper data management. So let me ask you, are you drowning in your groundwater data from your site? And what data should you use? You have these mounds of data. Do you know what is important, what is valuable for use in statistics? And do you know where to start when you have these mounds of data? And what's this data trying to tell you? And lastly, how can you make the best use of this data? It comes across and it seems like it's just overwhelming. And how do you know that you're using it in an optimum way? Do you have enough data to make an adequate decision, to make an action? So when you're thinking about these statistical approaches, let's think about how the statistical approach can help manage your groundwater data. You know, if you're not a statistician, we feel like this course is going to help you make a more informed decisions about statistics, give you confidence to spot misapplication and mistakes, help in the review of selecting tests or reviewing reports that have different statistical tests selected, and just over understanding the language of statistics. Then if you are a statistician, we're saying that this course and the document will help you make work and conclusions more understandable to the general audience. So ITRC feels like that this groundwater statistics and monitoring compliance statistical tools for a project lifecycle, or let's just call it GASMC document, is the solution for this problem. It'll help you ask the right questions when applying statistics. It'll direct you to an appropriate statistical method to have and maximize the value of your data. The groundwater team statistical team was formed back in 2011. And what occurs was that we brought together experts from the Department of Defense, EPA, Department of Energy, along with consultants and state regulators, to put together this package of information in a usable and accessible web-based document. Existing regulations vary across many of the states. We recognize this, but you can still take the opportunity and advantages of using statistical practices to explain what's happening with your data. Let me give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about. In this first example, a regulatory challenge, we have 8 sampling events that occurred after active remediation was finished. And as we see it, as many times the data is going up and down, we really can't make certain of what is going on. I put on there that the criterion for the standard for this parameter was 0.5 milliliters, 0.5 milligrams per liter. And you might see, well, we have 2 consecutive values there starting in June of 2011, and maybe that's good enough for closure. But that doesn't give you a certainty of your decision. In our web-based document, we explain that you might use an upper confidence limit around the mean. And Chris and Liz will both be talking more about what this means, but in this specific case, the upper confidence limit of the mean is 0.689 milligrams per liter, which is above the criterion. And so we can explain that with a 95% confidence, we're concerned that the mean could be above the standard for this parameter. In another case, we talk about the regulatory challenge of managing non-detect values or sensor data. We have here on this graph, we have a lot of data across many years, and what we have is the open circles were reported as non-detect, and then the closed circles are what the laboratory had as a detected value. And you see that over the years, the laboratories changed, the methods changed, and we have different non-detect values reported by the laboratory. And so this gives a confusion in, well, what value should we really use for that non-detect reporting? And so if we were, as we show here on the slide, if we just use a simple substitution, the mean of all these values would be 0.0078 milligrams per liter, and then this upper confidence level of the mean would be 0.0125 milligrams per liter. In the web-based document, we point out that there are statistical methods that will approximate what that non-detect value would be compared to the detected values around it. And such case would be the Kaplan-Meier method, where the mean then would be more like 0.002 milligrams per liter, and the upper confidence level would be 0.0055 milligrams per liter. And it, with this case that we had, standard was 0.01 milligrams per liter. And so as you see, the upper confidence limit did depend on what we used for the non-detect values. And with this case, you can once again explain to the public more clearly with the statistical method that your of your assurance of what the non-detect what the non-detect value might be, and the upper confidence level of the of that distribution. In our document, we feel like it'll help you in reviewing your groundwater data and making statistical calculations from reports, make recommendations or decisions based upon those statistics, and demonstrate compliance for groundwater projects. We feel like that this document will help you in doing those things. And building from your technical background and environmental experience in site compliance and cleanup, you'll be able to use this web-based document even if you don't have specific expertise in statistics or access to an in-house statistician. And we're going to show you how. Here is a roadmap basically of our training that we have. I'm starting out trying to help you understand how to use the GSMC document, and then we'll go into using the data and understanding applying statistics to your data. We'll have a question and answer period after that, then we'll come back and we'll talk about specific areas of using your statistics in background compliance, trend analysis, and monitoring optimization. Then we'll come back with a summary and have a second question and answer period. The document is basically broken up into these five life cycle stages. And we have given this terminology to the stages, but I'm sure you're familiar with how that as you go through an environmental project, you might have these different areas to deal with. And within each one of these areas, you would have specific groundwater goals, monitoring tasks, and with that, groundwater statistical tests that would support your decisions through each one of these cycles. What the team then did was they basically came up with these different problem statements or questions that would deal with statistics and your groundwater data. So that maybe you had a question about, is there seasonality in the data? And what you will find in this web-based document, if you were to click on that, it would go to the seasonality portion and explain how that you may have a misapplication of seeing a trend when it's really just seasonality, or, and it also explains how you might be able to use different methods to take out the seasonal variation and so that you can better see how the distribution is laid out. The document points out this question as it's usually relevant in the remediation, monitoring, and closure state life stages of the document, of the life of the environmental project. Then next, what we have is we are, with these study questions, we're building a bridge then from your project life cycle to the statistical approach, whether it's you're trying to understand the exploratory data analysis, picking a correct method, or even picking the correct software to help you answer these questions and do these statistical methods. With this understanding of the framework of the document, let's look at how you might go through the document from the beginning. On the first page, the welcome page of the document, we have this logo, which is interactive. And as you enter the document, you may just want to go, well, I'm in the detection phase of the life cycle, and you would click on that, and it would show you the different statistical methods that you might use to evaluate your groundwater data during that time, and also the different questions that might be used. Or if you're reviewing a project and they say, well, we're going to use a specific statistical method, you could come in here, click on to the statistical method, and it would explain those methods and help you either go to the software tools that you can use to calculate that method, but in any case, to give you a better decision for your project. Then also, as it being a web-based document, we have these links to different other resources that are available. This document by itself is not a tutorial on statistics or specifically on how to do things, but instead is guidance on helping you pick the right method, to how to answer the questions you might have. And one of those go-to documents is the Unified Guidance Document, where all the methods are linked to that document so that you would know how to calculate how the method is actually used in answering that question. Then second of all, we also have links to the data quality objective process. As we first talked about those mounds of groundwater data, you need to have a data quality objective process to make sure that it helps in identifying the type and the quality and the quantity of data that you need for to come up for the specific use that you have in your project that you're doing. So that we have links to the different data quality objective processes. Then, of course, we have other statistical references, textbooks, the ASTM methods, and a list of found in Section 9 of that document. So with that, I think we're ready to learn how to apply our data, how to apply statistics to our groundwater data, and I'll turn it over to Chris Stubbs of Rambo and Varon to take it from there. Chris?
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Harold. So, in this next section, we're just going to review some of the basics, concepts of using statistics for evaluating groundwater data. And just to start off with, thinking a little bit about what statistics is, and I like to think of it as the science of drawing conclusions from data, because that's what we're trying to do. And there are some tools for visualizing and understanding the data that can be very useful. And oftentimes we're trying to separate the signal in our data from the noise. And in the case of groundwater, the signal would be actual changes in groundwater quality associated with a facility, for example. And the noise would just be natural variation in some of those parameters. So we're trying to separate those two. And in other cases, we're interested in the sort of large-scale kind of a summary of the behavior of a system where we're looking at many data points and figuring out how to summarize them. And in all cases, we need to think about uncertainty and how to quantify it, and ultimately, trying to make better and more defensible decisions and using our data most effectively for that. So we're going to look at some of the major elements of a statistical approach. But before we do that, I just wanted to describe a little crime story. And it's not a serious crime, thankfully. It's just a burglary of some laptops from an office. And in this case, the police were able to apprehend someone. And that person, Mr. Shifty, went to court, and he decided to plead not guilty. And it's kind of useful to think about the sort of system that we use in the courts to decide guilt or innocence, and some draw some parallels with a statistical approach. So when you're a defendant, there's an assumption that you're not guilty, at least in a criminal trial, and that's that kind of presumption of innocence is like a null hypothesis that we'll find out in statistical testing. And then the prosecution has to present evidence. In this case, there was some pretty good evidence. There were some fingerprints, Mr. Shifty, on the stolen goods, and actually found those stolen goods in his trunk of his car. So some good, strong evidence. And then it's up to the jury to decide whether that evidence was sufficient to convince them beyond a reasonable doubt. So there's a sort of a threshold that the prosecution has to meet. And we'll see there's a kind of a similar parallel to that in statistical decisions. Now, why do we organize our trials this way? And basically, we want to cut down on the number of mistakes we make. Probably the worst mistake would be to send an innocent person to jail for something they didn't do. And in statistical terminology, we might call that a false positive error. And the other kind of error is, of course, is a guilty person goes free. And that could be called a false negative error. We generally consider letting a guilty person go free less serious of an error. And we'll see that when we're making decisions in a groundwater context, depending on where we are in the life cycle, one of these mistakes may seem more serious than the other, and we should think about that when we're designing our statistical approach. So a good way of organizing these different types of decisions, sort of kind of understand them, is in a little table like this, where we sort of match, we have the sort of true state of nature here, which is not contaminated or contaminated, and then we have whatever our decision is based on the data, which is here we decide it's not contaminated, and here we decided it is contaminated. So for this example, we'll sort of think about a site that's in the initial phase, initial site characterization phase of the life cycle, and in this case. We might go in with the presumption that the site is not contaminated, because we don't have any information to think that it is. So we'll go in there with a sort of a null hypothesis or presumption that the site's not contaminated. We look at the data and try and figure out what we think. And so if we get it right, the site really is not contaminated, then we're sort of in this box here. And if we get it wrong, when we basically say it's contaminated when it's not, then we're over here. And we sort of think about the probability that we're going to do that, and the probability of a false positive type mistake is symbolized with the Greek symbol alpha, as shown here, and we usually call that the significance level of our statistical test. And the other kind of situation is if the site really is contaminated and we get it wrong, that would be the false negative error, and we symbolize the probability of that happening with beta. And we think about usually, you know, how likely are to get it correct in this case, and that's called the power. So those are just some statistical terminology that we'll look at a little bit more as we go through. Just a little bit more of a reminder, as I said, you know, we have these two different types of errors, and one is usually more important. So, you know, in this case, we're in the site characterization phase. You know, we don't want to miss a contaminated site and let it go by without further investigation. So that type of error would be more important than the site characterization phase. We've often heard this phrase, statistical significance, and that really just means that there's a small chance that the result is a false positive. We kind of get to choose this, the level of significance, which, as I said, is symbolized with alpha. And, you know, in environmental work, and I think in a lot of medical research, we would look at a 5% error of false positive as being acceptable. And that's kind of like 1 in 20 times that we might do that kind of test, we would be wrong. So that's, you know, that can be a pretty big error rate. But in other fields, like physics, for example, when you're looking for fundamental particles or things like that, you know, they really accept a much lower possibility of being wrong, you know, closer to 1 in 3.5 million. So, and as I said, you know, in addition to the false positive, we also have to think about the false negative error, and we usually talk about that in terms of its converse, which is power, 1 minus the false positive error. That's a little harder to figure out because it depends on the variability in our data and our sample size and what's called the effect size, which is, you know, for example, how big of a difference in between the site concentrations and background are we trying to detect. And we have to remember to check the power of our work, too. So we'll just go through some of the key aspects of a statistical approach. Developing a site conceptual model, exploratory data analysis, which is what we want to do first with our data, and designing a statistical sampling plan, and then using the data to evaluate the level of statistical evidence and the uncertainty in our conclusions, and then thinking about the assumptions of these statistical approaches. So we're going to go through these in the coming slides here. The first one's about developing a conceptual site model, which is something we do all the time. Of course, it's something like a written or maybe graphical expression of what's going on with the site. Here's an example here of the landfill, where we have groundwater flowing across the landfill towards a river, and these little X circles with X's in them are groundwater monitoring wells. And they're measured at those wells. We've measured the specific conductance in, which is just related to the levels of dissolved solids in the groundwater. The one thing that's not a well is this one down here, which is a sample from the river. So it's just a surface water sample where we've measured specific conductance. And this river has some tidal influence. So the saline water from the oceans kind of moving in the river there. So there's a situation where obviously trying to figure out, has there been an impact or release to groundwater from this landfill? And the answer to that, we're going to obviously statistically evaluate the specific conductance. In a real-world situation, we'd look at other parameters, too. But here we're just going to focus on that. There's kind of two general approaches to doing this. The first is an inter-well testing approach, where we're looking at all the wells that we have, and we divide them into the background wells and the potentially affected site wells, and we compare those two groups of wells. And the other one we can use, the other approach, is an intra-well testing approach, where we just look at one well at a time, and we look at the time series of data from that well, and we divide the time series into two periods, one sort of before the landfill could have caused any problems, and the second is after that. And we compare those two time periods with each other. And depending on the CSM, one of these approaches might work out better. So in this case, just going back to the CSM here, we could compare this upgradient well here to the values down here. But the problem is that since the groundwater's got this tidal influence, that's going to make it difficult to figure out what's caused by the landfill and what's caused by the tidal influence. So in this case, good example of where an intra-well testing approach would probably work best. All right, next, we'll talk a little bit about exploratory data analysis. And this is what you do when you get all your data in there. You're trying to figure out, what's up with the site, what's going on, what data do you have, what is it telling you. And basically, you should just always plot it. Plotting the data is just makes it much easier to see patterns in it, because that's just how our minds work. And I've listed here some of the top five plots that we would use in our work with groundwater, and we'll kind of go through some examples of them as we move along here. First one we've all seen is the time series plot, where we plot the concentration in a well, for example, over time. Here's one with benzene in parts per billion. And this is a nice plot to look for trends and maybe outliers in the data. One reminder of this is it's really a good idea to always indicate whether you have non-detects or detects. Because here when we replot this showing the non-detects with the open symbols, we see that really there's not really a trend in the data per se. There's just a trend in the detection limit that we're getting from the laboratory. So that's always a good thing to remember to show that on your time series plots and other plots if you have them. Another very useful plot that's a little more of a statistical plot is the box plot, which is very useful for comparing two groups of data, which is something we're doing a lot of in groundwater evaluations, because we have background data and compliance data, and we want to compare those two groups. And a box plot's a nice way of doing it. So little components of the box plot, if you haven't seen them before, is the line here in the middle is the median of the data. And then the edges of the boxes represent the 25 and 75th percentile of the data. And then it has these whiskers that sort of stick out a little ways, and they can be defined in different ways. But the individual data points that are kind of beyond the whiskers are sort of indicating these more extreme values, which may be outliers that we should investigate. So it's a nice summary of both the central tendency of the data, which is shown by the median, and the sort of spread and outliers in the data. So it's a nice approach to use when you have two groups or more than two groups that you're trying to compare against each other. Next kind of plot that is useful is the scatter plot, where we might use it to show the relationships between two variables. So, for example, if we have a well where we've measured mercury and arsenic, we can plot those two variables against each other and show if there's a relationship between them. So here in this example, we see a pretty clear linear relationship where the arsenic and mercury really rise or fall together. So that's a useful plot for showing these kind of relationships between variables. All right. So the next little part, let's just talk about designing a statistical sampling plan. And we sort of need to do some planning, ideally ahead of time, before we collect our samples, because we're trying to figure out how many samples we need. And to do that, we sort of have to think about what kinds of statistical errors are important to us and how to control them. There's some good we have our online guidance from ITRC, which has got some good information about this, and there's some also other guidance available from EPA in the DQO, or Data Quality Objective Planning Process guidance, and also the unified guidance for evaluation of RCRA groundwater data, which is also quite useful for this kind of planning approach. In addition to planning before we collect our samples, it's also useful just to look at how well we've done after we've collected the samples, what kind of a statistical power we've achieved, because that kind of depends on the data that we've actually collected. The way to think about planning, designing the statistical plan, is that there are some trade-offs that we need to think about, and it's good to think about these explicitly, because we sort of have the sample size, which we can control, and, you know, obviously if you have more samples, then it's you know, easier to detect differences, and we can have a stronger power, meaning it's, we can, you know, figure out if there's actually a change in groundwater quality with a greater probability. And we also sort of have to think about this, what I've called here the effect size, which is, you know, how big of a change is really needed to understand. I mean, if it's really insignificant, small change in groundwater quality, then it might not be so important. So we have to kind of think about the trade-offs between these different elements when planning our statistical sampling. All right, so then after we've got our data and we're taking a look at it, we've done an exploratory data analysis, we've thought about our CSM and what we're trying to do. You know, there's different approaches for evaluating statistical evidence. And the first one we'll talk about here is hypothesis testing. And this is sort of parallel to the example of the burglary, where we have kind of go in with a null hypothesis or a presumption, and then we're going to see if the data is sufficient to convince us that that presumption is incorrect. So the presumption is called the null hypothesis, which was the not guilty in the case example, and then the alternative hypothesis is sort of the opposite of that. And we're trying to see, can we, get enough evidence to meet this sort of burden of proof to disprove the null hypothesis. Selecting the null hypothesis can be a little tricky because it's kind of, we sort of pick the opposite of what we're really sort of interested in figuring out. So, for example, if we're interested in answering this question, do the site concentrations exceed background concentrations? Well, then the null hypothesis would be that the site concentrations are consistent with background. You know, they're less than or equal to the background concentrations. And we would see if we could disprove that. Another example is if we're trying to figure out if the cleanup goals have been achieved, then a null hypothesis would be that the site concentrations are above the cleanup goals. And then the data would need to prove that they've actually been brought down enough to achieve the cleanup goals. And finally, if we're looking at whether there's a trend in concentrations, the null hypothesis would be that there's no trend. In other words, the slope of a trend line is no different than zero. We can't distinguish it from a zero slope. So here's the steps for doing hypothesis testing after we define the hypotheses. Then we use usually use the computer, take the data, compute a test statistic. And we kind of compute that test statistic under the assumption that the null hypothesis is true. So probably the most common example of the test statistic is the T statistic. If we're trying to do a T test, we do the T statistic. And we look up for that statistic, you know, what's the probability that we would have observed that statistic if the null hypothesis were true. And that probability is called the p-value. And oftentimes we'll really focus on the p-value. We won't necessarily look at the test statistic itself. look at the p-value, the probability that that test statistic could have occurred. And to make the to do the test, we compare the p-value that we get from our data with our significance level that we've decided on ahead of time. So if we have a 5% significance level, we'll compare our p-value from the test to that 5% significance level and see if the p-value is less than that. So if it's less than that, that means it'd be really unlikely that this data would have occurred if the null hypothesis were true. So if it's really unlikely, so unlikely that it's below our significance level, then we'll reject the null hypothesis. On the other hand, if the p-value is greater than that significance level, we won't be able to reject the null hypothesis. And you know, we might want to look at the power of our test to make sure that we really had enough data to do a good job of testing it. So as I said here, all these test statistics and their associated p-values are measures of the discrepancy between what you actually find in the data, what you have observed at the site, versus what you'd expect to see if the null hypothesis were true. And so what we're trying to do is figure out, you know, were these data just from natural variability that might have occurred under the null hypothesis, or was something else going on causing us to reject that null hypothesis? And so it's the how small the p-value is gives some measure of the strength of the evidence against the null hypothesis. With the smaller it is, the stronger the evidence. All right, that is all about hypothesis testing. There's other approaches we can take, though, besides hypothesis testing. Oftentimes, we'll use the wells at a site to calculate a mean concentration. So from this example here, we've got a mean concentration of 5.1. And we want to ask ourselves, how reliable is this estimate of the mean? And, of course, that depends on different things. One, how many samples we've got to look at, and also the variability in the data. And a good way of showing this reliability is to use statistical intervals. We can use these intervals to show the reliability. We often call these intervals, you call them error bars. You've kind of seen them on points. We've got little error bars going on either side of the point. There are different types of statistical intervals. The most common one would be the confidence intervals. But there's others that come in handy, which ones would be prediction intervals and tolerance intervals. And we'll talk a little bit more about prediction intervals in a second. But associated with these intervals is a confidence level for the interval. So that's the kind of the probability that our error bars include what we're interested in. So we often define a confidence level of 95%, for example. And we'll see later that we can actually use those confidence levels to conduct hypothesis tests. Particularly, this is useful when we are comparing our data to a fixed standard, like a MCL, maximum contaminant level in groundwater. All right, a little review here on confidence and prediction intervals. So confidence intervals, most of us have seen before. So these are intervals that are on statistics, meaning statistics are things that we've calculated from our data, like means or medians or slopes. When we've calculated something from our data, then we can put a confidence interval on that to show its reliability. Prediction intervals, on the other hand, are not for on statistics, but they're actually on future data points. So if we collect some data, so, for example, if we collect this data here on total organic carbon in a well, and here's all the data points that we collected, just plotted all the data points, and we can calculate the mean of those points, and we can put confidence intervals on that mean, sort of indicate the reliability of the mean. But if we want to know, well, what would happen if we collect a new sample? You know, where would it expect it to fall? And that's what the prediction interval. It tells me if I take a new sample of total organic carbon, I expect it somewhere within this prediction interval. And you can see that sort of goes a little bit outside the range of the existing data because, you know, there's always some uncertainty. We could get a new point that's actually a little bit bigger or smaller than the data that we've seen up to that point. So That's the distinction here. You know, the confidence interval is showing the interval around the mean, and the prediction interval is showing the interval around a future sample that we might take. Just one more note here. You know, we have a confidence. These are two-sided confidence limits in it. They have, you know, an upper limit and a lower limit. And sometimes we don't need to calculate both. We can just calculate a one-sided interval that just has an upper or a lower limit, depending on what we're trying to do. All right, so here's how we might use intervals to do some hypothesis testing. So we're going to show what happens under these different types of different phases in the site history here. So first, we're looking at a site where we're trying to look at the just characterize it. And when we go in with our hypothesis, usually the site's probably clean until we get some data otherwise. So our null hypothesis is that, for example, that the mean concentrations of groundwater are below the maximum contaminant levels or the limit in groundwater. So, and then of course the alternative hypothesis is just that they're greater than. So if we want to use our confidence limit, our confidence intervals that we've calculated on our mean, we would just look at the lower confidence limit on the mean, and we can compare that to the MCL. And if our lower confidence limit is greater than the MCL, then we can be pretty sure that the mean concentration itself is greater than the MCL, because we've kind of looked at this the sort of lowest plausible level of the mean. And if that's greater than the MCL, then, you know, we can be pretty confident the MCL is also greater than, I mean, the mean is greater than the MCL. Alternatively, if we're in the corrective action or remediation phase of the life cycle, well, we know the site's contaminated, so we're going to assume that it's contaminated unless proven otherwise. So in this case, the null hypothesis is that the mean concentrations on the site are greater than the MCL. And then the alternative is just converse to that. And if we want to use the confidence intervals to do a hypothesis test, then we'd look at just the upper confidence level on the mean, and we compare that to the MCL and see if that upper limit is less than the MCL. Because the upper limit's less than the MCL, then we're pretty confident that the mean itself is going to be less than the MCL, and that the site has been properly remediated, and, you know, we could stop the remediation or something like that. All right, so finally, we'll just go through a few of the assumptions that we often have in our statistical approach, and we should test these, or at least evaluate these. First one's just about outliers. You know, often we have this case where we see something like this shown in the plot here, where we just have, you know, one data point that's just way out from the other ones, potential outlier. And generally, we shouldn't just throw these out. We should look into them, see if, you know, there's an actual error, a laboratory error or a transcription error, whatever. And if there really is an error, then, of course, we should omit the data point from the analysis. But there is no error, then, you know, we have to tread a little more carefully, and we might try our statistical evaluation both with and without that point to see if it really matters. Or in some cases, we may just need to collect another data point just to replace that one that's doesn't make any sense. So that's about outliers. Another type of assumption that's very common is that the data follow a statistical distribution. And in our work with groundwater, we usually only look at these three kinds of distributions: a normal distribution, a log normal distribution, and sometimes a gamma distribution. And if our data follow one of these standard distributions, then we can use parametric methods that rely on the assumption that the data follow a particular distribution. But if the data don't follow that, then, you know, all is not lost, because there are some other methods that are called non-parametric methods that don't require this assumption. Sometimes those methods might require more data to make similar conclusions, but they're a little more flexible in that they don't require the data to follow a particular distribution. The easiest way to test for distributions is to plot the data. So here's a histogram, which is an easy plot to look at. And, you know, first off, we're trying to figure out if this is normally distributed. We'd look for a sort of bell-shaped curve where it sort of kind of goes up to a peak and then back down. So here, this is a pretty good example of something that does follow a normal distribution. We also have some more specialized plots, which are called probability plots, which make it a little easier to test this. And here, we put our data into a probability plot, and if the data points, shown with these little pluses, follow a line, go along the line, then we know that data set follows that distribution, and that we could use parametric methods. Some other assumptions that come up are independence. We've got both spatial and temporal independence. Basically, for when we're counting up the number of samples, the sample size, we're supposed to be counting independent samples. So if we take two samples one day apart, the samples aren't really independent. They're basically sampling the same thing. So it wouldn't really be fair to count those as separate samples. So we have to think about those kind of issues of temporal independence and spatial independence if, for example, the wells are right next to each other. Obviously, if you're looking at temporal independence, you don't want to sample too often. And you obviously can't ever use these sort of duplicates as independent samples. You could, incorporate them in the analysis, but you wouldn't count them as separate samples. Often when we're comparing with background, we want to have a stable background, meaning there's no trend in the background. For example, here's a background data set that obviously has a little bit of a trend in it. It's an increasing trend. So if that's the case, we may have to remove that trend from the background or look for a different set of data in order to compare to background. So finally, just a little summary here, a reminder to always plot the data. That's basically always a good idea. Think about appropriate error rates and what kind of error rates you need to make a good decision. You have to think about if you really have enough data to make that decision. You may need to collect more in some cases. There's many different regulatory requirements for statistical analyses, so you really need to look into those and make sure you're following the right ones. And you always want to combine the statistical analysis with other lines of evidence, just basic good common sense, hydrogeological principles, things like that. You don't want to just work in a vacuum with the data. And then finally, just a reminder here, if you torture the data long enough, it will confess to anything. So just a reminder to use common sense and making a good decision. So that is it for this section. And next we have a question and answer break.
Thanks, Chris. Everyone is welcome to send in questions. If you're in the phone line audience, you can unmute and ask questions out loud. That's #6 to unmute. As we're going to go through this first question and answer break, we are going to do a poll question as well. So we're going to ask you to select the areas where you use statistics on your projects. And this is one where you can select all that apply. So if you don't see all of the answers, you can scroll down on the side and there'll be other answers available. We've had a few questions that have come in, and I'm going to go ahead and jump back to slide 29. The explanation that the presenter gave of the detect versus non-detect does not seem to be accurate. The graph showed non-detect only in the last three sample events. To me, it shows that there was a decrease over time until it reached non-detect. Give me one moment. I'll jump back to slide 29 so you can see that one.
Yeah, okay, so here's slide 29. So with the exception of the last four data points, all the values were non-detects. So the last four were detects, and they kind of just sort of jump around. So I would say, it's not really very strong evidence of a trend there in the actual detected concentrations. And you only have kind of four data points to go on. So an example just to remind everyone that it's important to consider the effect of non-detects, and it's very useful to include those as symbols, separate symbols in your plots, whatever type they are.
How does one evaluate the appropriateness of background data when compared to site data? Is it important to have the same number of samples from background as from the site?
Well, that's a good question. That's where we kind of get into the statistical design questions. You certainly don't need to have the same number of data, and usually you'd have fewer background points often than site points because you might have fewer wells that are in background. So you don't need to have the same number of points, but you do need to consider how much data you're going to have in the two different groups, the background and the site wells, and then think about what kind of false positive and false negative error rates you would be able to cope with that amount of data. So that's something you'd have to think about in the context of whatever regulatory framework you're in.
Our next question refers to slide 37. And the question is, less than MCL or the MCL within the 95% UCL?
I think it might be maybe, is it the next slide where we're talking about the comparing with the MCLs? So here we're, for example, for the corrective action framework here, we look at, like, for example, the upper 95% confidence limit, and we compare that upper limit to the MCL. And if the upper limit is less than the MCL, then we kind of have pretty good confidence that the mean itself, which is going to be, somewhere below the upper limit, is also going to be less than the MCL. So that was the idea there. Hopefully that is the question that was being asked, but if not, you can follow up with that.
What do the whiskers represent on the box and whisker plots?
Yeah, they can be defined different ways. Usually they're defined as some multiple of the interquartile distance, which is the difference between the 75th and 25th percentile, so the two edges of the box, and then you sort of multiply that by some factor, which can be different depending on how you're defining them, but it's off something like 1.5, and then so it's sort of meant to be a measure of where most of the data is falling. So that if you see a data point that's outside of the whisker, then that would be something you'd look at for being an outlier, potential outlier. So that's the purpose of the whiskers, and they can be defined different ways, but you have to kind of look in the specific software that you're using to see exactly how they're defined.
For box plots, which are good for comparing two groups of data, what would be the approach be for a large site? Do you need to break up the groups spatially? Perhaps you could use the landfill example.
Usually we tend to be, we're sort of in a landfill type situation. We're trying to figure out if there was a release or not. And in that case, usually you only have the two groups, which is the background versus the site wells. But, depending on your situation, it could be quite useful to look at different areas of the site that maybe have different characteristics, and to show more than two box plots. You could have a whole line of box plots, and that's quite common where you're looking at box plots, sort of a whole line of them of 6 or 8 box plots that represent different things. Another common way of using them is to look at, to sort of summarize concentrations from different chemicals. So you'd have a box plot for each chemical and kind of compare them, summarize your data for different chemicals that way with the box plot.
Is there a minimum number of samples you need to perform statistical analysis?
Yeah, there is, certainly. And it kind of depends a little bit on the specific situation. But I believe in the guidance, the sort of online guidance, we've tried to put a guideline of 8 to 10 samples as being the minimum number for you know, that would be applicable to most situations. Sometimes some situations you might need more than that. Some situations you might be able to get away with less than that, but that's a pretty good rule of thumb.
Isn't sample size a consideration for a parametric or non?
Yeah, well, it does make a difference. I think, as I said, often for parametric approaches where you have an assumption that your data follow a particular distribution, you can kind of get conclusions with fewer data points than for non-parametric methods that sort of don't have that assumption. So they kind of have to rely on the data themselves for all the information. So you tend to need more data points for non-parametric methods than parametric methods. And depending on your situation, you know, that may be a consideration. You know, most of the time, though, it would be easy enough to just apply both a non-parametric and a parametric test to your situation and sort of see if you get kind of compare those two results and see if you get consistency between them. You might feel a little better about the conclusion than if you did.
How far back in time would you go on a trend plot? For example, if I have 5 years of data, is the past year or two more important when investigating the trend?
Well, I guess most of the time you would probably be more interested in, more recent history. And I guess, one of the issues with the trend analysis is if you put a really long, you have a really long historical record, that there may be different trends at different time periods. So it might make sense to divide up those time periods. And you could just do it graphically, sort of by looking at the data and sort of calculating trends for different periods, because there might be some differences there.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break. Looking at our poll results, it looks like we have a lot of people that are experienced with background, compliance, and trend analysis, but not as many with monitoring optimization. And these are all topics that we're going to cover in the second half of today's training class. So thank you for answering the poll question. Before we move on, I do want to remind you about the feedback form. We do look for everyone on the call today to take just a few minutes at the end of the class to fill out the feedback form. And if you leave before we wrap up, you can get to that by the middle section, the related URLs. The second one down is the feedback form. So you select the name feedback form, you look down a bit, and you select that browse to button. That's going to open that feedback in a new window for you. We really do use your feedback. We're developing new training courses, and we also have the chance to improve this training course. So we do appreciate you taking a few minutes to give us your feedback. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. So right now, the only way to get a certificate is by attending the class, fill out the feedback form, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. And once you submit, the system then is going to generate a certificate for you. And if you have more than one person at your location, you can just go back and have the next person fill out the feedback form. If you forget to check that box, just go back, check the box. Right now, the only way that certificate gets generated is once you check the box and select the submit on that feedback form. So we really do appreciate you taking a few minutes to fill out the feedback at the end of today's training class. We'll now continue on with the second half of our training, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Liz Simmons at Kleinfelder. Liz?
Thanks, Juliana. We're now going to present some different examples of the application of statistics to groundwater sites. So in the next few sections, we're going to go through some study question applications and use the project lifecycle to highlight the concepts and statistical methods that Harold and Chris just presented. And these could apply to some typical questions that you may be considering. So because of the time involved, we're not going to be able to cover all the questions in this training, but we'll give you a flavor of what's in the guidance document. And if you want to get into any further discussions of the study questions or look at all the study questions, They're found in Appendix C in the document. Since groundwater statistical methods have applications throughout the life cycle of environmental projects, we're going to use the project life cycle stages and the study questions to illustrate the connections to some hypothetical sites. And these questions that you see here were developed by the team to kind of easily navigate through some typical issues and questions that may come up during various phases associated with groundwater monitoring, and also ways to evaluate that data. So in the table here at the left, we show the project life cycle stages, this time as columns, and the study questions are listed on the right. And the study questions that generally apply to each of the life cycle stages are noted with the X's in the table at the left. In the guidance document, we use this as the main tool to connect between the life cycle stages and the study questions. And it's also used to help the reader find information that's relevant for their particular site. The first question or concept we're going to discuss is background. For background, there are two questions, questions one and two. Question one, what are the background stages, applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, and closure. For study question two, are the concentrations above background applies to release detection, site characterization, monitoring, and closure. So, what is background? Sometimes the concept of background can vary from state to state or the various regulatory agencies. But what we're talking about here specifically is site-related versus not site-related. In general, both native and man-made sources need to be taken into account. However, you've got to establish a baseline first, because groundwater may already be tainted with concentrations of a contaminant from either native or man-made sources that would make it difficult, if not impossible, to clean up to what may be considered a pristine standard. And the web-based guidance document addresses this in more detail. Now, background is usually tied to some sort of a regulatory threshold, whether it's a criterion like an MCL, a risk-based criterion, or maybe some other threshold, but it's tied to some sort of a regulatory threshold. Now, back on slide 31, Chris discussed intra-well versus inter-well. And consider this as a time-only relationship versus a time-space relationship. For intra-well samples, you're sampling the same well many times. So you're looking at essentially what would be a before, if possible, a during, and an after contamination picture. And natural factors typically don't affect intra-well samples, only what happens over time. For inter-well samples, you're comparing different wells, and you're generally comparing what you're considering as upgradient or background wells with downgradient or compliance wells. So here you're actually evaluating samples over both time and space. So when you're evaluating background, what do you need to consider? The first thing is known sources. And by this, I mean how many sources are not related to site contamination. And you need to look at the distribution and direction, the geology and the hydrogeology information that you might have. For example, the estimated groundwater gradient, if you've got fracture flow, evaluation of intra-well versus inter-well data. Do you have multiple aquifers? For example, a perch zone, multiple aquifers, you're not going to want to cross-contaminate. And you need to look at your data quality objectives, and these should be developed up front before you start your investigation. Now, we know that's not always the optimum, or you're not always able to do that, but you also need to take a look at what data that you do have and take a look at from this point on. What you need to be looking at for your data quality objectives. And for this, you need to have a sufficient number of samples that provide reliable results. And you also need to look at the quality of your data set. For example, you know, if you're looking at a data set that's, you know, 15, 20, you know, 25 years old, do you have multiple detection limits from, you know, various methods? So basically what this comes down to is that you need to develop a good conceptual site model to maximize the validity of whatever assumptions that you might have. As Chris talked about in the previous segment, we should use exploratory data analysis methods to help evaluate a potential background data set. And this is discussed in detail in sections 3.3.3 and 3.5. An initial step would to be simply inspect the data to determine frequency of detection, representativeness of samples, whether there are one or more detection limits, the time span of the data. Can some of the data be too old? You know, if you're looking at data from, you know, 20 to 30 years ago, does this not reflect the state of your site over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years? Also, the consistency of the analytical methods. For example, if you've got BTECs, you may have, over the history of your site, data that were analyzed by EPA methods 80-20, 80-21, or 80-260. So you need to take that into account as well. To get a quick visual, you can use graphical methods such as histograms, quartile plots, box plots, or scatter plots to plot the data set, which will provide some insight into the overall spread and potential distribution of that data that you do have. And you also need to determine the distribution of the data set to figure out whether it's parametric, for example, whether it's normal or log normal, or non-parametric, where it doesn't necessarily fit a normal distribution, or there may not be enough samples. And I think that was one of the questions that someone had asked before, or at least in our online data set. And, based on this, you need to evaluate which statistical methods will be needed in your evaluation of background. For example, if you're looking for outliers, a t-test, which is a parametric test, is sensitive to outliers. All right, here we have an example. Most regulatory governance, for example, RCRA, requires the establishment of background. And this example shows how potential background well data could be evaluated to determine whether the data set can be used to characterize background. This particular example applies to study question one, what are the background concentrations? And also to study question two, are the concentrations greater than background concentrations? For study question one, we'll use descriptive statistics and we'll use inferential hypotheses for study question two. Now, this example site shows a hypothetical metal recycling site. Once again, this is not a real site. We've kind of, created the data here, where arsenic is the primary chemical of concern and a groundwater plume has been characterized. For this site, conceptual site model has been completed and validated. Our hydrogeology has been studied. And based on the hydrogeology, the upgradient wells are wells 1 and 2, which are up here. Let me move this around. The side gradient wells are wells 7 and 8. And the down gradient wells are wells 3 through 6, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And this is based on the conceptual site model. The objective here is to identify whether a data set would be consistent with background. We first would select a potential data set and then evaluate the quality, the shape, and the distribution of the data set. What are the data quality objectives and how do they apply to the number of samples that are required for analysis? Once again, you take a look at this. Are there any non-detects that have to be addressed? And does the data have a stable mean and variance? Are there trends? Are there outliers? And what's the distribution? So these are all things that you need to look at. For this particular example, we selected data set for the two hydrogeologically upgradient wells over a 2-year period. And for our purposes, this should give us a sufficient number of samples to meet our data quality objectives. In this particular data set, you'll notice there's no non-detects, and mostly because it's metals. You're looking at arsenic. And because upgradient wells because they're upgradient, and just because this particular set, both wells are also below the MCL. So we've got a couple of graphs going around here, and what I want to talk about a little bit is some background tools. And there are a number of methods and tools that do preliminary statistical analysis. For example, you can have probability plots, you can have time series plots. For the interpretation of the results, you need to understand what the source of the variation is. Is it natural or is it man-made? You need to take a look at environmental settings. Very often, if you can get some information from research or published studies, there's a lot of information that's out there that's available, you know, not just in hard copy, but, you know, just Google and you can find almost anything. There's also temporal changes. For example, are you in a rainy season versus a dry season? This is especially, you know, effective out west. And then, based on your analysis and interpretation, does your conceptual site model need to be revised? Just remember that conceptual site models are living documents, and if there appears to be another upgradient source, update your conceptual site model. If you have additional information that you didn't have before, update your conceptual site model. This is, as I said, it's an ongoing thing. In this case, based on the graphical methods we've used, well, W1 appears to be fairly consistent with what would be expected for a background well, where well W2 has a couple of points or outliers that may be called into question. Now, upon further research, those two points both occur in April when there's a larger runoff from the mountains when there's higher arsenic concentrations in the rocks. And therefore, both of these can be considered background wells. More often, though, a specific reason for the outliers isn't known. And this is where statistical methods can come in handy in being able to manage that outlier data. Next, we're going to discuss how statistics apply to monitoring compliance. And for monitoring compliance, we move to study questions 3 and 4. For study question 3, are concentrations above or below a criterion applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, remediation, monitoring, and closure. And for study question 4, when will that criterion be met, applies to project life cycle stages for remediation, monitoring, and closure. Now, because of the time constraints we've got here, we're not going to be able to go through study question 4. But once again, if you go to the online document, you'll be able to find a discussion of that. So why do we do monitoring and evaluate site characterization? To evaluate site characteristics, and site characteristics can be evaluated based on a combination of both spatial and temporal data. And also for compliance, to see if the chemical concentrations are in compliance with that groundwater protection criterion. So for monitoring design, you need to look at what are your potential contaminants and how have they changed over time. For example, if you're looking at chlorinated hydrocarbons in your suite of analytes, you might have PCE, TCE, and vinyl chloride. So you need to take a look at where that is with respect to, you know, how far down the line you might be. Monitoring design, also to identify a release. It helps you firm up or develop a conceptual site model and also can be used for compliance with regulatory requirements. That groundwater criteria compliance can be based on a number of things. You can have, can be based on an MCL. It can be based on a background value, some sort of risk-based value, based on an exposure scenario, or it can be based on an ecoprotection value. And the basis of compliance, and the compliance measures should be presented in your quality assurance project plan. And this should give you, you know, the number of samples that you need to do your statistical analysis, what that distribution is, for example, parametric, where it's normal or log normal, versus non-parametric, where it doesn't fit the distribution or there may not be enough samples. What's the regulatory threshold? And this can vary depending on what compliance criteria that you're addressing. And also the compliance point. It can be a number, a maximum value, or a maximum limit, or a set value. So now we're going to go back to examples here. And for our monitoring compliance sample, we're going to focus on study question 3. Are concentrations above or below a criterion? And once again, we're looking at our hypothetical metal recycling facility. And as we're looking at this, remember we've already determined that wells W1 and W2 are background wells, W7 and W8 are side gradient, and based on where we've got the plume, those two wells are also located outside the plume. And so for this question, we're going to focus on the downgradient wells, well W3, which is closer, W6, W5, and well W4, which is farthest away. So here's our data set for wells W3 through W6. If you look on the left, as I said before, W3 is the well that is closest to the source, and W4 over on the right side is the well that's farthest away from the source, and wells W6 and W5 are intermediate wells. So in this data set, notice that it has the same number of samples and data ranges as we saw for wells W1 and W2, and it also meets our data quality objectives. There's no non-detects in this data set again, but also note that in this particular data set, it mimics an actual laboratory data set where higher concentrations tend to have fewer significant figures based on threshold detection limits. And based on our conceptual site model, as I said, W3 is closest to the source, and W4 is farthest down gradient. W5 and W6 are our intermediate wells. Now, we're going to look at wells W3 and W6 first. And if you look at these, the first thing you notice is that the samples from W3 are about 6 to 9 times the MCL. And samples from W6 are about twice the MCL. But there's also less variation in the data than you see in well W3, or the samples from well W3. In this slide, we're looking at the samples from wells W5 and W4. And the samples from well W4 are all below the MCLs. They're fairly consistent, while the samples from W5 straddle both sides of the MCL and have a slightly larger spread. For W3, W4, and W6, you may not need statistics. That may be true, but it's also a misconception. And there's also always uncertainty in the results. And the real usefulness here are in the sample results from, W5, which is the harder case. Chris previously discussed data distributions and confidence intervals in his sections. As we're evaluating the data from these four wells in our example, we need to look at confidence intervals. And once again, these are discussed in greater detail in the guidance document. There's many kinds of confidence intervals, but they bind a single population, and the mean or average is a typical confidence measure. The mean here is shown as the horizontal colored lines. So let's see if this actually works this time. That's not working. The horizontal colored lines And for example, the mean for well W3 is set in green, and the mean for the well W4 sample set is in blue. And the mean is based on multiple observations so that it's, a decision can be made with some sort of statistical confidence. For example, 1 point doesn't prove the mean or max is below a certain criterion, and one above that doesn't violate that criterion. The vertical black arrows show the confidence interval on the mean for different well sample sets. For example, the variability of the confidence interval for W3 sample set, which is the black arrow by the green, is greater than that for the W4 sample set, which is the black arrow by the blue. And confidence intervals can also be measured around other things such as an upper percentile or a median. And percentiles can vary too depending on your risk tolerance, but you know what we typically look at in statistics is a 90, 95, or 99%, and those are typical values. The number of samples required to calculate the confidence interval for your site should be based on your data quality objectives, and there should be a sufficient number to compensate for variability of data, uncertainty, false negatives, and false positives. So let's take a look at some more information that we've got here, and I kind of pointed out that, you know, you can look at things and statistics can help, or you can say you might not need statistics, but you never know. So let's take a look at this example. Now, this particular site happens to be in the state of Washington, and since it's in Washington, we must use the guidance that's been prescribed or designed by the state. And it should be noted that this is one method, and it doesn't match up with what's in the unified guidance, but this is what the state has chosen. So in the unified guidance, we talk about regulatory barriers for various states. And Harold also mentioned this previously. Now, after we go through the Washington state example, we're going to go through an example of this project as a reference site that uses the unified guidance. And these two samples are given to illustrate how the results of statistical analysis are used and that they're used in different ways by different regulatory agencies. Now, because of this, CLEAN will most likely be based upon a state-prescribed basis that may or may not be statistically based. In this example, the data for the wells we're evaluating uses the state of Washington compliance test, which starts out with a comparison of the 95% UCL. So that's what we've plotted here. Okay. So what I'm going to do is go through the three points of compliance for the state of Washington guidance. And the first one is the upper 95% confidence interval on the mean less than the cleanup standard. So for well W3, W6, and W5, the answer is no. And for well W4, the answer is yes. The second criterion is the maximum data point value less than 2 times the cleanup standard? So for wells W6 and W3, the answer is no. And well W5 and W4, the answer is yes. And the third criterion is, are 10% of the data above the cleanup standard? And for wells W3, W6, and W5, the answer is yes. And for well 4, the answer is no. So if we're looking at this by the state of Washington guidance, wells W3, W6, and W5 are not in compliance, and well W4 is in compliance. So the main question here is, if the concentrations remain above that groundwater protection criterion, then when will the site be in compliance? As referenced in our guidance document, when we're looking at a RCRA situation, and this is based on 40 CFR 264.99, the US EPA's unified guidance document is typically used. So let's take a look at the same site based on that guidance. As Chris described earlier, from a release detection point of view, the MCL represents an average concentration, and the appropriate statistical test is the null hypothesis with the mean less than the groundwater protection criterion. And this is where the mean is assumed to represent the true mean concentration. So we can conclude that a well is in compliance when the lower confidence limit of the mean is less than the groundwater protection criterion. In other words, because we don't know what the true mean is, we assume that it could be any value within that confidence interval that we've calculated. So even though the mean might be greater than the groundwater protection criterion, we're not out of compliance until the lower confidence limit is also greater than the mean. Now, if we look at the table that we have up here right now, we've calculated the 95% confidence interval for the mean of the concentrations for each well under the assumption that the data were normally distributed. To evaluate the distribution, you may use distributional tests, which are described in Section 5 of the online guidance, to figure out if your data follows, you know, a distribution or what kind of distribution that they follow. You need to look at the assumptions in your test as you go through this. Okay, now after we've looked at the distribution, we then compared the lower confidence limit to the arsenic MCL of 10 micrograms per liter. And so when the lower confidence limit was greater than the MCL, we concluded that we're out of compliance, and vice versa when the lower confidence limit was less than the MCL. So in this example, using the unified guidance, wells W3 and W6 are out of compliance, and wells W4 and W5 are both in compliance. Now, keep in mind, though, that in this assumption, this is from a release detection perspective. The null hypothesis is the well is in compliance. If the groundwater protection falls below the UCL, or the upper confidence limit, then the null hypothesis will not be rejected unless the groundwater protection criterion is also below the lower confidence limit. And this is to be sure background exceedances don't predetermine any relationship of those increases versus the groundwater protection criterion. Now, if we're looking at remediation or corrective action, then the null hypothesis is actually reversed. So just to kind of conclude this, again, this is just to demonstrate the differences in regulatory framework. And I'm now going to turn the time over to Randall Wrighty, who's going to talk about trend analysis and monitoring optimization. Randall?
Yeah, thank you, Liz. So we're going to cover our last two topical areas here in this training. And so trend analysis, if we remember back to the poll we had a few minutes ago, trend analysis was actually one of the more frequently applied analyses. And so that's a good time to remind people of something that's useful in the web-based guidance document. So if you are familiar with the technique, you know, maybe you need to communicate with some colleagues that aren't as quite familiar, so you can point them some sections in the web-based guidance document, or if you just want to verify some assumptions for a particular test that you're running, that's another good resource there. Yeah, also, in case anybody's following with their own PowerPoint package, we're currently on slide 65. Okay, so trend analysis. So trend analysis actually applies to four of the 10 study questions. And I'll note that, so for question number 8, which is changes with distance, we're not going to cover that today in this training and because of the time constraints. So if you're interested in that particular question, I refer you to section 5.15 of the web-based guidance document. But basically, the questions are looking, is there a trend? Is there seasonality, which is a particular kind of trend? And also looking at attenuation weights in wells, you know, how soon will concentrations change below a criterion, and what might be happening in the future to your trends? Well, Chris and Liz have both presented you know, graphs, and so again, so the first thing you probably should always do with the data set is take your data set and plot it. And so a scatter plot is one of the things that we typically use with trend analysis, and this is just illustrating a simple example, and it's actually from the Unified Guidance, the EPA 2009 document. So in this case, we were just plotting all detected concentrations, and there you can see they're changing over time some. And but if you look at just the plot, you know, they're going up and down a little bit. You know, what's the overall trend in these data? So when you do a statistical analysis, it helps put the data in a little bit more context. In this case, we're just showing an example of linear regression, which is a parametric method. So it's assuming a normal distribution for these data. And it's just, you know, showing a line now, overall data. And so now it's a little bit clearer on what kind of trend there is. And so the trend we're interested in is knowing whether or not there is a, you know, direction of change, is it increasing or decreasing, and also the rate of change. And the rate of change in this case would be given by the slope of this line. The steeper the slope, the faster the trend is occurring. Well, where can we apply trends? So trends apply lots of places, and that's probably one reason why people have experience doing trend analysis. So exploratory data analysis, an example. So just thinking back to an example that Liz just provided, our background level is stable. And the reason why this is important is because if your background concentration is actually changing over time, and for example, you're maybe trying to do an intra-LEL comparison, then you know, you have potentially an issue with associating, you know, the trend may be overall decreasing, and you may get a misimpression that you know, concentrations are actually going down over time, that there's not a release, evidence release. And likewise, if concentrations are increasing, you can also get a misimpression. And there's other ways that background data or other data can be not stable in a statistical sense. And we can also apply background to other cases in release detection and assessing compliance, you know, looking at the future, can we apply monitored natural attenuation? And then we're actually going to talk about optimization. Is the sampling level appropriate in the next part of the training? So I won't talk much more about that right now. Okay, well, what about an example? So if we, again, in the web-based guidance document, one of the features of this document is we have some examples. And if you look at Appendix A of the document, you'll find this particular one. This is example A.2. And, of course, the first thing, you know, once again, we plot the data. In this case, we have a data set that's varying quite strongly over time. And so this is showing a couple orders of magnitude, basically changing concentration. And so the other thing about this data set is it's collected over different quarters of the year. And so I've now just highlighted the October samples, the sampling period. And so this would be, in essence, the fourth quarter. You'd have, you know, January, April, July, and then October. And so to evaluate seasonality, there's some things that you need to do. So one thing is you're plotting the data. Another thing that you can do is you can you know, look at the adjusted data. So the adjusted data is actually taking in consideration, in this case, the overall mean. So we have a value here that's the dotted line, that's overall mean. And the adjusted value is taking the value that we see in particular sampling events. In this case, we have four quarters. And so the October values are kind of one group. And you can see the October values tend to be high. And then you look at the basically what it forms as a residual. So it's then going to be adding the difference in general that you have for that particular event. And so this is similar if you've done analysis of variance from that tool. So it's looking at that as kind of a factor. So you have, you know, a quarter factor in your sampling periods. And then what you can do is actually come up with this then solid red line, which is the adjusted data. So the adjusted data is varying quite a bit less than the original unadjusted data in this example. So what can you do next with this? Well, next you could take the adjusted data, and you can, so this is again, so now we're just looking at the data after it's been adjusted for seasonality. Seasonality's been removed. In this case, we're just showing a couple of example ways of looking at the data. So one is linear regression, and the other one is this teal send line, which is a non-parametric method, so assuming no distribution. And one thing is you can see that these two different methods actually come up with fairly similar slopes, just a tiny bit of the offset and where they intercept at 2,000, which is the zero point in this particular plot. So we're not advocating that you would run just whatever method you like and come up with results, but this is showing that in this particular case, you're coming up with pretty similar results. And this is because actually the data are log normally distributed, and so we're plotting these data on a log scale, and therefore then linear regression is an appropriate method because they're log normally distributed. Okay. Well, what about another application of trend analysis? And so this is, again, the study question 7, what's the attenuation rate? And so one of the things you can do with this particular analysis we're showing here is that we have a trend for TCE concentrations. And again, we're showing a confidence bound. So there's the overall trend is this middle gray line using this Thiel-Senn method, so a non-parametric method. And then you can come up with a 90% confidence band, which is now these dashed dotted lines around above and below that line. And then the last thing we have displayed here is the cleanup goal. And so one of the things you can do is say, well, okay, what's the surface sampling event? So the first sampling event that's below the cleanup level is at this point. And if we want to say with one confidence, 90% confidence that we're now below, it's now this event. And so one of the important things about this particular example is that we're actually taking information within this time period. So it's about a 2.5-year period. And we can see a pretty nice trend, and we can see that the data follow a nice line. And we're just interpolating within what we've already measured. And so that's kind of interesting, but really in most cases we're more interested in taking another approach and looking and seeing what might be happening in the future. So let's look at that. So this is again using the example we were looking at a couple slides ago. So this is our example 8.2, so it's the same data set. And we're looking at this period here. So here's our period, and we have data around this point here where we have about a 12-year period of measured data. And then what we're interested in doing is saying, well, what if we take this data, this model, and we extrapolate it out into the future? And so basically the model is just going to be this line here. And if you look at this line and you look at these bounds, so here's the confidence bounds. Confidence bounds are kind of centered with the minimum value here where we are basically within the range of the model. And you look at going into the future, that these bounds are increasing. Now, conceptually, this is kind of similar to what you see with like hurricane forecasting. If you look at where a hurricane is in one day, it's got a fairly narrow bound. And then if you look at out in a week, it's got a wider bounds. And so in this is just reflecting the uncertainty in that fairly complex kind of model. And this kind of model, it's really fairly simple. The main thing we're estimating from the data here is the slope. And so we have an estimate of the slope, and basically the line that's fit, that's our best estimate of the slope. But if you think about it, well, maybe we've underestimated that trend a little bit, and so really it's going to be a steeper trend, and so that's a more beneficial period. And so if you look at that, well, maybe it's going to be out here at 2020 plus where we have, best case scenario for the model, fitting this MCL. And if you look at then a more worst case scenario, well, it's a shallower slope. So again, a shallower slope will lead to a longer time before you get to that predicted value out. And it's going to be around 2070 to 2080, so off the scale of this particular plot. So again, this is the case where we're taking a data set and we're extrapolating into the future. And we're using one of the model parameters, basically the slope, to help us do that. Okay, what about the last topical area? So monitoring optimization. So one of the things that to note in monitoring optimization is that, a couple of things. We have, there's a couple of questions first. I'm going to go over those. So first of all, when you're looking at optimizing, well, the thing is you have a sampling at a particular well over time, like the examples we've given. And sometimes we have an example where we have, a dozen years. And the question is, do we have an adequate frequency of samples, events per year or over time. And then the other question is we have, multiple wells characterizing a plume, and we're trying to estimate some aspects about the plume in terms of its mass or something like that. And do we have, an adequate coverage, spatially, do we have an adequate number of wells? So those are the two quite a study questions. Something else to consider, though, is that when you're doing optimization is a statistical process. But what's important is having an appropriate conceptual model because, for example, if you have a site and it's got multiple aquifers, you know, you might have a shallow and a deeper aquifer, and they don't particularly mix. Well, when you're evaluating the data spatially, you know, you're not going to want to mix together data from different zones, hydrological zones, for your optimization. So that's kind of a basic thing. And then there's other things like Chris talked about in the example where you have a river. So there's some complications in terms of how you're going to actually evaluate the data and make sure that you have, you know, an appropriate evaluation, and it's the conceptual model that really helps you do that. And another thing is that we have actually another team, ITRC team, Geostatistics Remediation Optimization, and they offer a training class also. And to a large extent, they build on some of the things we have in the groundwater statistics world, but they deal with soil contamination, other parameters as well. And so that's something to look for on CLUIN and the ITRC pages, and you know, sign up for that training if you're interested in more details. But basically, the optimization purpose is to make sure you have basically the right amount of data for addressing your decision. And then when you're looking at this from a statistical perspective, that you don't have a lot of correlation or redundancy in their sample results. And again, that you have adequate data for making an accurate decision. So in some sense, you could always collect more and more data, and you can have a more accurate decision. But one of the things you look at in optimization is, you know, making sure you don't have, like Chris was saying, you don't select samples on the, you know, consecutive days, because that's basically kind of wasting effort, time, and money, and that you can then say, well, maybe we only need to sample this particular, you know, well, only once every 6 months as opposed to once every quarter. So that's the idea. Temporal optimization is simpler, and it's something that's not really covered in the geostat too much. And we have some information in the web-based guidance document. And basically, one of the ideas is that you have, you know, sampled over time, as we had. And as this sampling event, if you sample once a quarter, you get very redundant results. And statistically, this is autocorrelation. Do the data correlate to themselves over some period of time? Like our example from Appendix A, you know, there was a seasonal, which means kind of an annual correlation in the data set. And the idea is it can adjust the frequency, you know, to minimize this correlation but still capture any trends we have in the data set. So, again, there's another example in Appendix A, 8.4, and this is just, you know, one of the two wells we looked at in this example. And one of the other things to note with any of these optimizations is you can imagine you can actually do this yourself. You could say, let's take data from a well, and I can remove, and I could take out samples and look at what results I get. I can, you know, what's the trend after removing results? Well, luckily, there's some software, and so this example is work with the Visual Sampling Plan software, and this one's relatively used. I've used it for some different projects. And the idea here is that you have a data set, original data set, and you're just showing the solid black circles as the data set. And so one of the things that the VSP software will do is then take the data set, and it's going to fit an overall trend. In this case, it's a smooth data set using an interpolation method. And so that's what those circles that are filled with red are showing here. And then the next thing is basically a confidence bound. And so you have, in this case, a 90% confidence bound selected. And the idea is, well, how much of the original data do I have to still keep in order to maintain this confidence bound, you know, having, you know, be able to reproduce this trend with some degree of confidence. So in this particular case, the sampling turned out to be, the solution was 227 days. So you sample once every 227 days, or in essence, you can sample twice a year instead of multiple times a year, four times a year. So that would give you the same trend. And one reason why I show this particular example is because the other thing when you're looking at optimization and you're fitting models, like we talked about with the, you know, extrapolation, is that there's also a lack of fit. So you have some of the data down here. And so in the other example, we actually had a much better fit, and we didn't have this issue with a lack of fit of some of the data. But this could be a question of the optimization approach if you're fitted line doesn't capture all the data. So there's some fraction, in this case it's about 10-15% of the data are really outside of the model range. So the values are low, so maybe that's not quite such a concern, but this is kind of a rationale for saying, well, can I live with, you know, taking away some of the data if I'm going to miss something that's happening that's not kind of captured by the model? Okay, what about another approach for optimization? And this is also another software tool that's available. This is the MEROS tool, which is the Monitoring and Remediation Optimization System. And so this one is, this is just illustrating the chart. So basically you're going to do some statistical analyses of the well that you have and a particular contaminant in the well. And in essence, if you have lots of contaminants, you would repeat this process for each one of them that's of interest. And so the chart is broken up, you can see, in kind of two directions here. So first of all, let's just cover this axis here, so the rate of change. So this is the rate of change, and it's going to be using linear regression to determine the rate of change. And the rate of change is going from high to low. Well, the way the MEROS is working is it's looking at high as being two times the MCL, or whatever standard you're using, and low is less than half. Okay, so that's kind of how that's gradating. And you can see that then there's a letter here, Q, and it's saying, so if you have a high rate of change, MEROS is recommending quarterly sampling in general, semi-annual for in-between, and annual for low rate of change. And then if you can think about this from this particular chart's perspective, then there's a Mann-Kendall, which is the direction of the change. So it's either increasing or decreasing. That kind of refines this this sampling. So if you have an increasing trend with a high rate of change, then you're more likely to be looking at quarterly. If you have a decreasing trend and a lower rate of change, it's more likely to be annual. So that's another approach, and there's some other tools within some of these other software tools that we have identified in the web-based guidance document too. Okay, well, let's switch gears and talk about spatial optimization for a few minutes. So just like in time series, temporal, you're looking at some optimization, in this case is the number of wells. In some sense, you can have wells that are giving you redundant information. They're sampling really the same part of the plume. There's a lot of mixing in that area, and so when you collect a sample and you go over 10 or 100 meters, you might be getting very much the same result. So that's one part of it. So, but the other aspect is, well, you might have some areas where you don't have a lot of data, and so this is a different kind of question. It's like you don't really know what you might find, and there's some spatial models that can help you to determine where to put new wells if you don't have information. So again, you can think about this. The easy thing conceptually is you could take your data set of wells, and I can remove a well or a group of wells and see what happens to the results. But luckily, there's some software tools that can help us do this as well. So just to kind of illustrate, what some of the tools are and to give you a little bit of a cautionary story, here's one of the methods. It's an interpolation method. So this is just showing these, here you have like a small part. N0 is meant to be like your focal well here. And then you have these surrounding wells. And based on the geometry of those wells, then you can come up with basically interpolating, and this is one form of interpolation is using these Delaney triangles, and there's also Thiessen polygons and other things like that that can do interpolation. And so these different methods have different kind of assumptions and pros and cons, and actually that's one of the nice things in the Geostat course. They go really into a lot of detail about some of those different options. But in terms of the tools that you can apply to groundwater network evaluation. So there's some, and basically this is going from the simple to complex and genetic algorithms. So genetic algorithms don't refer to anything regarding biology. These are actually computer programming algorithms that can help you take a fairly complex problem. So you can imagine if you had a monitoring network of several dozen wells, it could be fairly laborious, and there may be very difficult to come to the solution of optimal solution. And so that's what these computer programming tools use. And this GTS Smart, which is a part of the GTS software, is one of these related tool. There's other things that are slope factors and relative errors. That's a geostatistical method, and people may have heard about kriging, which is a specific kind of a geostatistical method, and then a more qualitative evaluation is possible, especially if you have a fairly small network. It's fairly straightforward to apply that. So then the cautionary note about this particular example, if you think about one of the issues in spatial is really edge. And so this is just showing an example of how you do the interpolation. But if you think this is being your edge and you only have this one well, there's only one well that's basically surrounded in all directions by other wells. And so for these other wells, like at this edge, there's a lot of uncertainty. And this is one of the important things when you're considering methods and results. And again, you can have things like boundaries, like rivers, that can create, you know, realistic constraints on what should be happening with your groundwater contaminants and flow. Well, what about kind of just a screenshot? And this mentioned GTS, so the geotemporal spatial software. So we have reviews of these different software. This one is in Appendix D. Section 6, and this is kind of illustrating what some of the capabilities are of this particular tool. So first of all, it's giving you kind of a plan view of your site. There's some information on some different kind of surfaces there, probably roadways and parking lots and things like that, and buildings. And then it's showing you here these plus symbols are all your monitoring wells, and there's some out here. They're mainly clustered around these buildings, maybe some release points. So one of the things it's looking at is constructing a grid, and then it's going to look at what we have here is coefficient of variation. Coefficient of variation is a measure of the uncertainty, and you can see here you have, in some cases, there's circles on top of each other. So GTS can actually handle more than one contaminant at a time when it's doing the optimization, which is nice. And then you can see that there's a small circle inside a big one here. It's just helping interpreting some of these results. And so basically, it's giving you a plan of view of your sites. This is laying some of the optimization work is done initially. And you can just see very qualitatively, there's some big circles here for at least one class of contaminant. And so this would be an area probably where you would want to be adding wells. There's also some small circles over here. You don't probably need to know much more. And you can see there's a lot of wells in some of these areas here. So probably have redundancy there. So just a more qualitative view of what you get out of that software. But then let's kind of summarize this. There are a number of different tools we identified in this document that can help you do this optimization. And we have a list here in references to this Appendix D where we do reviews of the software. And these software tools are kind of ranked from the more simple to the more complex. The GTS software is the only one that does of this list both the temporal and spatial optimization concurrently. For example, VSP does them independently, but you can do them and then you can kind of merge the results. So that's, I think, it for my section, and turn it back over to Harold to wrap it up.
Okay, thank you, Randall. So in summary, before we conclude our training, I want to make sure we cover three more sections of the document in a little bit more detail. The data management section, the statistical methods section, and the software tools, all of which can be directly accessed through the web-based document. First of all, on the statistical methods, we're in Section 5. What the team has done is they've brought together these different methods that you would use, statistical tests, to evaluate groundwater data. And we've lumped them into 14 different groups based upon their application and relevance to the study questions. And as we go through them, you might click one like trends, and it would list the different methods that would do trend analysis. It would give you the assumptions and the requirements, the strengths and the weaknesses, and then also, as we've talked before, would reference the unified guidance on how the method actually is calculated and more detailed information on that. Next, as Randall was talking about, this Appendix D, the team at the time, probably 3 or 4 years ago now, sent out a survey and also their own experience, came up with a list of 23 software packages that deal with groundwater data, statistical evaluation of groundwater data. And at that time, we did an evaluation of the different software packages, got an approximate cost of those software packages at that time, the operating system requirements, the ease of use, how the data is imported, benefits and limitations, and of course the reference if you wanted to find out more about the software package, as well as capabilities. The team put together, looked at each one of these software packages and rated how they were, the different capabilities of these software packages, so that if you were to click on one of the software packages, it would give you that information, and also you could come up with the capability table. What we have here is the screenshot of one of the software packages, and just it would go through each one of the topics of the statistical methods and would discuss their capability of that software to handle that method. So like, for example, in this software package, full circle means that it's fully capable of doing that method. A half circle is it's partially capable or it has some limitations. And then a blank means that it has no capability. And then also there were some software packages where you could add on scripts, and in this case that was not applicable. But as we said, this was done 3 or 4 years ago, and this specific software package now has a limited capability of doing the Kaplan-Meier test. So that when you use our document, we want to make sure you understand that you need to also go out and do your own research on the software packages to make sure that they do what you want them to do and that they will meet your needs for this statistical evaluation and the management of your data. Some of the packages were designed for specific environmental data, and others are just general software packages that have a business or scientific application, and so you do need to make sure they meet your needs before you would purchase one of these software packages. With this web-based document, you can come directly to this table and click on the software you want to use. You know, so as I've talked before, this web-based document is user-friendly so that you can get right to the answer the questions that you have within the document. Then next, we talk about the big challenge of the groundwater data management. As we talked about early, these mounds of groundwater data, how do you handle it? First of all, as we pointed out, you data quality objective procedures that helps you understand what part of the data is usable for your specific need and what part of the data you'll be using for your statistical evaluation. We wanted to point out that there are many large data-based systems. The EPA and the Department of Defense have their database systems already designed so that when they do a groundwater sampling event, the laboratory will just automatically format it so it can be dumped into these different databases. Indiana specifically has their own formatted system as well, where you can have the laboratory submit the data in the format so it can be easily uploaded into your downloaded into your database. In any case, in Section 6 of the document, it talks about the different elements that you need for your database and how to streamline your data analysis through this database system, and provides the basic structure for that. In summary of our training today, we hope that you have become more confident with using the statistical concepts, better able to select the appropriate statistical method for your project, and the appropriate software tools that you will use in your project. Also, within the practical applications of using the statistics, you'll be ready to use it in four key areas we talked about, in how that it will help you in determining your background, in understanding the compliance of your monitoring system and the data, implementing the trend analysis, and monitoring optimization. Those four key areas were chosen for the training, but the guidance document provides user-friendly explanations for other uses of statistics for your groundwater data. In closing, let me recommend, the team wants to recommend that you go to this address and allow the web-based document guide you in and using this appropriate statistical methods to address common project tasks. And as we showed here, the logo, in any case, we want to make sure that you use this ITRC document as part of your toolbox of managing your groundwater data. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Juliana for your additional questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Harold. We are going to have a few minutes for additional questions, so you're welcome to type those in. Before we get to our questions, I do want to point out our related URLs. So we have additional resources. This is where you can download the presentation, you can access the document, you can access many of the other links that I'm going to mention as well. We also have our link to our feedback form, and we do ask everyone to fill out the feedback at this point. We really do use the information that you provide, not only to improve this training class, but also as we develop new classes. And it's also your opportunity to get a certificate. So if you would like a certificate, it's through the feedback form. Complete the form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. Once you submit, the system will generate a certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again. I've also included in the related URLs a last item if you are interested in that online training on geospatial analysis for optimization. That is available next week, July 25, and the link here in the related URLs is going to allow you to access the page with more information, and then at the top of that page there's a button so you can register. So again, to get those related URLs to work, you select the name that you're interested in, and you look down a bit, you select that Browse To button. We do have some questions that have come in. Slide 82, when evaluating spatial adequacy of a well network, are there tools that consider aquifer boundary conditions or lithology and hydrogeologic characteristics?
Yeah, that's actually a great plug for the geospatial course. So they have in that guidance, there's some methods discussed. So basically you're just looking at optimization with a constraint, and so there's different ways mathematically that can be done. But yeah, sure, there are some methods, and that's just one thing that's why, you know, the conceptual model is so important in terms of the optimization, because it's not just strictly a statistical approach, although you can apply different tools to help you make sure you do it as correctly as possible. Yeah, that answer is yeah, there are some, and I just refer you to the other guidance document for some good discussion on that.
A question that's come in, is there a recorded version of this training to go back and rehear? And the answer is, once this recording is available, everyone who registered for the class will get an email with a link to that. If you don't want to wait, if you want to rehear an earlier offering of this same class, it is available. So you go back to that Clue-In training page where you started today, and tomorrow that page is going to have a link that will take you right to an archive of the past offering of that class. So if you want to listen again, come back tomorrow to that same page that was in your confirmation and reminder emails, and that's going to give you a link where you can right away hear a recorded version of the training. Where is the capacity rating shown in Appendix B?
Yeah, so there's a table that has that information, and I think it might be at the beginning of each discussion of software. Harold, is that correct?
Right, as you would pick a software package, it would be, I thought it was the last page of each software.
Oh, so it's the end of one.
At the
so,
bottom.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It's not at the front. Okay, yeah.
Several examples during today's class referred to a 90% confidence limit. Is this common for most groundwater compliance evaluation? I thought most regulators required using 95% confidence limit, but maybe not.
Yeah, that is a maybe not. So that's a good question. So confidence limits are something that you determine during your project planning process. DQOs are their systematic planning process, and so lots of times people will use a 95% confidence interval, but there's really no requirement, and there are some cases where, you know, the recommended value, if you even go to something like pro-UCL, they'll sometimes recommend a 99% confidence interval, but you can select different values, and there's just different consequences for, obviously, decision errors when you select different values. But there's a trade-off between your, as Chris was talking about, between that confidence interval and the differences you can detect. So that's that power value. So, no, it isn't always 95, but 90 is used, and some other values are used as well.
Do you find most groundwater data results to be distributed normally or non-normally?
Well, I would say that in general, they're probably not normally distributed if you're dealing with contaminated sites, but oftentimes people will assume that background might be more normally distributed, and that's not always the case, but and it depends on the particular analyte. You know, like if you have organic with a lot of sensoring, then it's you're not going to have an easy time telling the distribution. But frequently, lots of times it's what we call distribution with a long tail, which is something like a normal. So there's a few high values and quite a few low ones in general, but there can be any kind of distribution possible.
Thank you. I've also opened a poll question. So as we're finishing up today, a poll question for our audience to answer. Are you ready to use the statistics to better understand groundwater data at your sites? And then also thinking about the projects you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? So we do have both those again set so that the audience can see the results as they come in. So this is your chance to maybe think about how you're going to use it and discuss it with others on the call. We have a question that refers to slide 70, and is the adjusted data in slide 70 correspond to the observational mean? And I'll jump us back to slide 70 here.
Yeah, so this is actually kind of complicated to explain verbally, but when I was trying to go through this example, so what we have are the raw data, the original data, and those are the numbers that vary quite widely. So the other thing that's shown on here, and the reason why it's shown on here is because it's used as part of the, basically when you do the adjustment, is this overall mean. That's that dashed line. And then the third thing that we don't show here would be the event averages as well. So if, remember, I was telling you, it's like analysis of variance. So basically you're taking your data set and you're looking at how it kind of decomposes into different parts. And then ultimately what it's doing is saying, well, given that you're in this event, it's more likely to have a high value in October. Basically, you're going to kind of discount the October values by that value, because now the October has its own kind of trend. I guess we can go and look and just highlight the October ones maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's not working. But so that's the idea. So that's why we show this mean. So we're not really showing you all the calculations. So again, and not to plan on this one too much, but if you go look at how the example is written up in A2, then actually this is also something that's covered in the EPA Unified Guide. But that's kind of the idea, is you have basically a trend, an overall trend, and then you have different events that have their own trend as well, in essence. And you're adjusting it, basically reflecting that value.
Thank you.
So hopefully it helps a little bit.
Is there anywhere in the document where we can find an example of data analysis and explanation?
Well, I guess I think really in the appendix is where we have worked up some examples. So if you want to see it in essence from the data set to here's the results we have. And I think it does discuss the software tools that we use in the appendix as well. But, you know, that's one place. And I think that when there's different, tools being discussed, that they also discuss it in terms of, you know, how you would see it being applied. So I guess you start with, what topical area you may be interested in. Or so if you know you're interested in trends, you can go to that part of the, of section 5, and you can see what different tools are there. So that's the nice thing about the document is you can go in from different directions and, kind of see how it's presented. But, yeah, there are some places where it gets into some more detail and shows you how things are worked up, what assumptions are relevant for your data set as well.
Thank you. We are out of time. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you have questions that we haven't addressed, please email them to training@itrcweb.org. That's the same email that you got for your confirmation and reminder emails about that about this class. You can just respond to those. And if you are interested, please sign up for the class next week. That's July 25.